This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents Underground Airlines. Written by Ben H. Winters. Read by William Demerit. For my kids and their friends. No future amendment of the Constitution shall affect the five preceding articles. And no amendment shall be made to the Constitution which shall authorize or give to Congress any power to abolish or interfere with slavery in any of the states by whose laws it is or may be allowed or permitted. From the 18th Amendment to the United States Constitution, it is the last of six amendments that, together with four congressional resolutions, make up the so-called Crittenden Compromise, proposed by Senator John J. Crittenden of Kentucky on December 18, 1860, and ratified by Congress on May 9, 1861. Part 1. North. It is a strange kind of fire, the fire of self-righteousness, which gives us such pleasure by its warmth, but does so little to banish the darkness. Augustine Craig White, From the Dark Tower, a pamphlet of the American Abolitionist Society, 1911. Chapter 1.
"So," said the young priest, "I think that I'm the man you're looking for."
"Oh, I hope so," I said to him.
"Oh, Lord, I do hope you are."
I knitted my fingers together and leaned forward across the table. I was aware of how I looked. I looked pathetic, eager, nervous, confessional. I could feel my thin, cheap spectacles slipping down my nose. I could feel my needfulness dripping from my brow. I took a breath. But before I could speak, the waitress came over to pour our coffee and hand out the menus, and Father Barton and I went silent, smiled stiff and polite at the girl and at each other. Then when she was gone, Father Barton talked before I could.
"Well, I must say, Mr. Darkson, go on and call me Jim, Father. Jim's just fine. I must say, you gave Llewellyn quite a start."
I looked down, embarrassed. Llewellyn was the receptionist, church secretary, what have you. White-haired, apple-cheeked lady sitting behind her desk at that big church up there on Meridian Street, St. Catherine's, and I suppose I behaved like a wild thing in her tidy little office that afternoon, gnashing my teeth and carrying on, throwing myself on her mercy, pleading for an appointment with the father. It worked, though. Here we were, breaking bread together, the gentle young priest and I. If there's one thing they understand, these church folks, it's wailing and lamentation. But I bowed my head and apologized to Father Barton for the scene I'd caused. I told him to please carry my apologies to Miss Llewellyn, and then I brought my voice way down to a whisper.
"Listen, I'm just going to be honest with you and say it, sir. I'm a desperate man. I got nowhere else to turn." "Yes, I see. I do see. I only wish..."
The priest looked at me solemnly.
"I only wish there was something I could do."
"What?" He was shaking his head, and I felt my face get shocked. I felt my eyes get wide. I felt my skin getting hot and tight on my cheeks.
Wait. Hold on now, Father. I ain't even..."
Father Barton raised one hand gently, palm out, and I hushed up. The waitress had come back to take our orders. I can remember that moment perfectly. I can picture the restaurant, dusk lit through its big windows. The Fountain Diner was the place, a nice family-style place in what they called the Near North Side in Indianapolis, Indiana. On that same Meridian Street is the church, about 50 blocks farther downtown. Handsome, boyish Barton there across from me, no more than 30 years old, a tussle of blonde hair, blue Irish eyes, pale skin glowing like it had been scrubbed. Our table was right in the center of the restaurant, and there was a big ceiling fan high above us, its blades turning lazily around and around. The bright sizzling smell of something frying, the low ting-ting of forks and knives. There were three old ladies at the booth behind us with thin beauty shop hair and red lipstick, their walkers parked in a neat row like waiting carriages. There was a pair of policemen, one black and one white, in a corner booth. The black cop was leaning halfway across the table to look at something on the white one's phone, the two of them chortling over some policeman joke. Somehow I got through ordering my food, and when the waitress went away, the priest launched into a speech as carefully crafted as any homily.
"I fear that you have gotten the wrong impression, which of course... is in no way your fault."
He was speaking very softly. We were both of us aware of those cops.
"I know what people say, but it's not true. I've never been involved in
all sorts of activities. I'm sorry, my friend. He placed his hand gently over mine. I am terribly sorry.
And he sounded sorry.
Oh, he did.
His calm Catholic voice glowed with gentle apology. He squeezed my hands as a real father would, never mind that I was a decade or more his senior.
I know this is not what you wanted to hear, but wait, now, Father, hold on a moment. You're here, you came.
Out of compassion, he said.
Compassion compelled me.
Oh, Lord, I leaned away from him, feeling like a damn fool, and dropped my face into my hands. My heart was trembling.
Lord Almighty, you have my sympathy, and you have my prayers.
When I looked up, his eyes were straight on me and steady, crystal blue and radiating kindness.
But I must be truthful and say there is nothing else that I can offer you.
He watched me unblinking, waiting for me to nod and say, I understand. Waiting for me to give up, but I couldn't give up. How could I?
Listen, just, I'm a free man, as you see, sir, legally, so,
I said, then charging on before he could interrupt.
Manumitted years ago, thanks to the good Lord in heaven and my master's merciful last will and testament. I have my papers. My papers are in order. I got my high school equivalency, and I'm working, sir, a good job, and I'm in no kind of trouble. It's my wife, sir, my wife. I have searched for years to find her, and I found her. I tracked her down, sir.
I understand, said Father Barton, grimacing, shaking his head.
But Jim, she's called Gentle, sir. Her name's Gentle. She's 33 years old. 33 or 34,
I stopped, blinking away tears, gathering my dignity.
I'm afraid I have no photograph.
Please, Jim. Please. He spread his hands. My mouth was dry. I licked my lips. The fan turned overhead, disinterested. One of the cops, the white one, thick-necked and pink-skinned, reared back and slapped the table, cracking up at something his black partner had said. I held myself steady and let my eyes bore into the priest's, let him see me clear, hear me properly.
Gentle's at a strip mine in Western Carolina, sir.
The conditions are of the utmost privation.
Her owner employs overseers, sir, of the cruelest stripe from one of these services, you know, private contractors. And now this mine, I've been looking, Father, and this mine has been sanctioned half a dozen times by the BLP. They've been fined, you know, paid millions in these fines for treatment violations, but you know how it is with these fines. It's a drop in the, you know, it's a drop in the bucket.
Barton was shaking his head, gritting his teeth emphatically, but I wouldn't stop. I couldn't stop. My words had become a hot rush by then, fervent and angry.
Now this mine, this is a bauxite mine and a female PB, one of her age and her weight, you see. According to the law, you see.
Please, Jim. Father Barton tapped his fingertips twice on the table, a small but firm gesture, like he was calling me to order or calling me to heal. The compassionate glow in his voice was beginning to dim.
You need to listen to me now. We don't do it.
I know what is said of me and my church, I do. And I believe in the cause, and the church believes in the cause as a matter of policy and faith. I have spoken on it and will continue to speak on it, but speaking is all that I'll do. He shook his young head again, looked quickly at me, and then away from my frustration and grief.
I feel deeply for your situation, and my prayers are with you and your wife, but I cannot be her savior.
I was silent then. I had more words, but I swallowed them. This was a bitter result. I got through our brief supper as best I could, keeping my eyes on my plate, on my fish sandwich and coleslaw and iced tea. God only knows what I'd been expecting. Surely I'd not imagined that this man, this child, would be so moved by the plight of my suffering Gentle that he would leap to his feet and charge southward with pistols bared, that he would muster up a posse to kick in the doors of a Carolina bauxite mine, that he would take out his cell phone and summon up the army of abolition. For one thing, there is no such army. Everybody knows that. Everybody with sense, anyway. No such thing as the Underground Airlines, not really, not in any grand, organized sense. No command center in the deserts of New Mexico like there was in that movie they did a few years ago. No paramilitary force with helicopters and flash bombs waiting on the orders of a mighty anti-slavery general to rush into motion. There are rescues, though. There are saviors. It's piecemeal. It's small group action, teams of Northerners, daring or crazy, making pinprick raids into the hard fore, grabbing people up and hustling them to freedom. There are ad hoc efforts, small organizations, cells, each running its own route of the airlines. You just gotta know the right people,
And this man, this Father Barton here, he was supposed to be the right people. The man to get with. Everything I had heard, all the information I had collected, it all said that here in Indianapolis, in central Indiana, Father Barton up at St. Cat's, this was supposed to be the man. And now here I was, helpless, watching him eat a hamburger with a paper napkin tucked into his clerical collar, fussily dabbing ketchup from the corners of his mouth, listening to him assuring me in his soft voice to allay any concerns that everything on the menu had been certified by the North American Human Rights Association, a Montreal-based outfit that inspects supply lines. I nodded blankly. I murmured, "Oh," into my coffee. "Oh, good," like it mattered. Indiana was, like most states, a clean hands state, having a law on the books barring places of public accommodation from serving anything out of the four. All the rest of it, all the Canadian supply chain auditors, all the independent inspectorates and cruelty-free certification programs, well, that's all marketing. Fancy-sounding words to gin up donations for the anti-slavery nonprofits. But Father Barton, he pointed his skinny finger at the little gold seal on my menu like it was some kind of consolation prize. "I can't get your beloved out of shackles, you poor bastard, but I can assure you that your tomatoes weren't harvested by a shackled line." When dinner was done, Barton took out his wallet, and I put out my hand and laid it over his. "Hold on now," a little tremor rolled through my voice. "I'm gonna get this." "Oh, no." Father Barton shook his head and didn't pull away his hand, and we held that pose like an artwork. White hand on a brown wallet, black hand on the white hand. "I can't let you do that." "Come on now." I peered at him through my spectacles. I want to thank you for taking the time, that's all. It was good of you to take the time." The priest exhaled, nodded slightly, slowly removing his hand from our little pile-up. Here's what he was thinking right then. He was thinking, "Go on and let the man pick up the check. It's a gift to him, to let him feel he's done something." I do not want to sound crazy or something, but I do believe that I have this strange power in certain situations. To read minds, I mean. Not to read thoughts, not exactly. But to read feelings. To read people. To know how people feel. I dug a few crumpled bills from my coat pocket and smoothed them out on top of the check. Then I pushed a piece of paper across the table, a smudged scrap of napkin. "Here, though. That's my cell phone number right there, just in case you change your mind." Father Barton stared at the napkin. "Please, Father," I said. "Would you please just take it?" He took it. And he rose and adjusted his collar, and for a split second, I hated this man. This confident boy. "And I believe in the cause as a matter of policy and faith. Go to hell, son," I was thinking, just for a moment, just a bare half of a moment. "With your pity for me, and your stiff collar and your alabaster cheeks, you go to hell." I didn't say it, though. Nothing of the sort. I did not raise my voice or bang a closed fist on the table. Anger wouldn't help. All it would do, maybe, is draw the attention of those two cops, the white one with the thick neck and his laughing black partner, maybe cause them to amble over here in that slow cop way and ask Father Barton if everything was okay. Ask me if I wouldn't mind providing my paperwork for them to have a peek at, if it wasn't too much trouble. I excused myself to use the bathroom and hurried away, just barely keeping it together. Once I saw a businessman on TV, the owner of a Midwestern football franchise, and this very wealthy man was proclaiming his personal abolitionist sentiment while defending his use of the infamous temporary suspension of status rule to add PB muscle to his defensive line. "Do I like the system?" the man had said, shaking his head in his $1,000 suit, his $100 haircut. "Well, of course I don't. But I'll tell you what. This is an opportunity for these boys, and I love them. It's a bad system, but I love my boys." I hated that man so much, watching him talk, and I hated Father Barton the same way there in the diner. Slavery was a game to this child, as it was for that slick team owner, as it is for all the football fans who tisk-tisk about the Black Hand teams, but watch every Sunday in the privacy of their living rooms. Declaring hatred for slavery was easy for a man like Father Barton. Not only easy, but useful, gratifying, satisfying. And of course, its cold and terrible grip could never fall on him directly. My anger swelled. Then it drained, as anger does. By the time he hugged me consolingly at the door of the diner, by the time the priest was on his way to his car, by the time he stopped to cast a troubled glance back toward me, as I had predicted he would, as I had known he would, that glance found me standing perfectly still in the doorway, a humble man broken by pain. I had taken off my glasses, and there were tears slipping slowly, one at a time, down my weathered cheeks. The waitress poked her head out, reminded me that she had the rest of my supper for me all boxed up, and I could barely hear her. So busy was I composing this face of grief. Chapter 2. I've been free since I was 14 years old, and on this particular evening, as my dashboard GPS navigated me through the unfamiliar streets of Indianapolis, I was approaching my 40th birthday. The great bulk of my life then had been passed outside the hard four, in the free part of the land of the free. But even after all these years, I still found myself astonished daily by the small miracles of liberty. Just walking out of a restaurant with a clear head and a full stomach, holding a styrofoam box with leftover food inside it, just lingering in the parking lot for a minute before getting in the car, smelling the wet asphalt, feeling a light drizzle as it condensed on my forehead, just knowing I could take a walk around the block if I wanted to, go to a park and sit on a bench and read a newspaper, just getting in that car and feeling the vinyl give under my ass, feeling the cough and purr of the engine. All these things were small astonishments, miracles of freedom. I was in a modest Nissan Altima with a serviceable 175-horsepower engine and a dull tan interior. But I enjoyed driving it a whole lot. For most of my driving years, you couldn't get a Japanese car because the Japanese were signatories on the European Consensus, blocked from most trade with the United States. Luckily for me, a new prime minister had been elected in 2012 and switched them over to a policy of stakeholder influence, a phrase borrowed from the Israelis. Hate the sin, love the sinner. Open borders mean open dialogue, that whole line. I don't give much of a shit about international diplomacy, but I fucking love that Altima. It started up with no trouble. The heater worked, and the wipers worked, and the brakes and the windows and the tape deck worked too. I drove north on Meridian Street carefully, away from the Fountain Diner, away from Father Barton and his empty apologies. The world I heard described on the radio was the same as the one I could see through the streaky window of the car. Gray and ugly, redolent of violence and the fear of violence. This was the week of the Batlish hearings, fulminating in the Senate, furor in the streets. This woman's nomination had ignited a firestorm, as the radio liked to hype it. Protests and counter-protests in Washington, D.C., in the nominee's hometown of Philadelphia, and in plenty of other places besides. Violence. Violence and fear. There was some little local controversy, too, about a fundraising effort called Susie's Closet. Folks getting together in church basements to make care packages for the plantations, blankets and candy bars and all that kind of thing. First, they interviewed a local advocate for the homeless, asking why our attention should be down there when there's so much suffering right here at home. Then came a spokesman for the Black Panthers, denouncing the campaign as mere ameliorationism, calling Susie naive, which struck me as a little harsh, the girl being 9 years old and all. It was the usual stuff. All the new stories are just the old stories over again. I turned off the radio and fished a Michael Jackson cassette out of the glove box. The tape hissed when I pushed it in. It was a mixtape that I had made myself many, many years before. Soon they were saying new cars wouldn't have tape decks anymore, since the American market was finally catching up with CDs. Not yet, though. I turned up the volume, MJ sang Human Nature from Thriller, and I sang along. I was stopped at a checkpoint on my way back to my hotel, which I'd been expecting. Tensions were high because of the Batlish business, and because of a couple nasty incidents up along the 49th parallel. Indianapolis, like a lot of cities, had declared a heightened security environment, so cops were free to pull over black drivers when they felt like it, not like they ever needed a reason in particular. It was at 79th Street and Ditch Road that I heard the bloop bloop of the sirens, and I got out slowly, giving no trouble, showing my hands, standing where they told me to stand, staring blankly into the doorway of a grocery store while I got frisked by a beefy patrolman with bad breath and razor burn. He looked closely at my papers. My papers held up just fine. The sun was almost done sinking, a yellow smear against a dishwater horizon. Chapter 3. At the tail end of our dinner together, while we were tussling over the bill, I lifted Father Barton's wallet. This small and seamless maneuver caused me no difficulty or concern. I had performed the same quick action dozens of times in the past. There he was, poor man, embarrassed by my grief, flustered by my adamance, anxious to escape an emotionally charged moment. It would be a lot to ask in such complicated circumstances to keep track of something so prosaic, so secular, as a wallet. In the bathroom, I photographed its contents utilizing a tiny device that attaches to my cell phone. Then I slipped the wallet back into his pocket when I embraced him goodbye. And now, back in the Capital City Crossroads Hotel on 86th Street, with the door locked, with the shades pulled, I opened my laptop and began entering data into the remarkable mapping program I had on there. I entered the home address from Father Barton's driver's license. I entered the addresses of 3 restaurants and 5 gas stations he had recently patronized and from which he had helpfully held on to the credit card receipts. I entered the addresses of his gym, his local branch library, and the sport clips where he got his haircut. I entered, too, the Meridian Street address of the restaurant where we had just eaten, at his suggestion, and that of the parish church of St. Catherine's, where I had accosted poor old Llewellyn a few hours earlier. I'd never been to Indianapolis before, but I had been to lots of other cities, and every city is the same, neighborhoods and waterways, big roads and side roads. A circle of downtown in the middle, a circle of highway around the perimeter like a dog fence. Rich neighborhoods and poor neighborhoods, black areas, white areas, mixed, CVS and Starbucks, Walmart and town stores. The world is the same everywhere you go. In the north, I should say. The world is about the same in every northern city. I'm a lot less familiar with the south these days. What the mapping software did was turn each of the addresses into a blinking red dot. When I was done with the data entry and could take a look at the map, one of the dots sang out to me right away. It called my name. Most of the other dots were clustered together, centered around the priest's church up there on Meridian and just north of it, along the crowded shopping corridor of 86th Street, a mile or two west of where I was sitting. But this one dot was way, way down in a different part of town. It sat at the intersection of 38th and Graceland, in a neighborhood the map called Mapleton Fall Creek. All right, I said out loud. Well, all right. I laid a fingertip on that dot as if to feel it, to measure its strength. My name is not Jim Dirksen. Neither is my name Dudley Vincent, the identity under which I'd been staying at the Hilton Garden Inn near the Cleveland, Ohio airport until last night, when Mr. Bridge called me and woke me and told me to start packing. Mr. Vincent's driver's license and American Express card had since been cut to pieces, and those pieces were now buried in a construction site dumpster behind a Cleveland shopping mall. I had a lot of names. Or more precisely, it was my practice at the beginning of a new job to think of myself as having no name at all, as being not really a person at all. A man was missing, that's all, missing and hiding. And I was not a person, but a manifestation of will. I was a mechanism, a device. That's all I was. I looked at the dot on 38th Street. The dot blinked, and I blinked back at the dot. That address had come from a cash machine receipt dated 3 days ago, Sunday, at 4:32 p.m. $200 from a Regions Bank ATM. I tapped a few more keys, and the laptop whirred to life, accenting my map with the requested demographic information, shading every square block of the city according to its African-American population. When this was done, I sat back and laid my hands flat on the desk on either side of the computer keyboard. The main cluster of dots representing Father Barton's usual stomping ground. Those dots were in pale areas. Blocks with an African-American population of 10% or less, 5% or less. That one dot, though, the one blinking lonesome dot down in Mapleton Fall Creek, that one was singing a different song. It wasn't in the darkest part of the map. That was a 6-square-block area just northwest of downtown. That would be Freedmantown, I figured. But the area where Father Barton had taken out $200 on Sunday afternoon, there was some pigmentation down there, no question about it. I whistled very softly, still sitting motionless, hands still flat on the table. All right, I whispered. All right, all right, all right. Chapter 4. At 9:49 p.m., I stood from the wobbly wooden desk and stretched, raising my hands until they grazed the low ceiling of the hotel room. I felt around in the coat I had taken off and found a pack of Babas, tapped it on the edge of the desk, peeled off the foil, and took out a single cigarette. At exactly 9:50, my cell phone rang. It always rang at 9:50 exactly. Hello?
Good evening, Victor, said the voice on the other end,
low and even.
How is your progress?
That's what Mr. Bridge always said. Every time, when a case was on, when a file was active. He always called at 9:50, and his voice always sounded the same.
She's doing great, thanks, I said. How's your mother?
Mr. Bridge didn't laugh. He never laughed. He repeated himself.
How is your progress?
So far, so good. I slipped out onto the little balcony. The room was on the second floor, and I could smell the bitter fumes of the parking lot. To be honest with you, it would be a lot better if I had the full file.
You will.
So you've said. I lit the baba and took a drag.
Janice will post the full file by tomorrow noon at the absolute latest. It will be available for download from the second server.
Yes, Master, sure enough. Cold silence.
No chance of getting a laugh out of Mr. Bridge on that one.
I trusted his assurances about the file. My handler at the U.S. Marshals Service was a serious man, and he rarely made promises on which he did not deliver. And even with the full file being unaccountably late, I already knew the most important details. A person bound to labor had escaped. His service name was Jackdaw. His PIN was 78312-99. The company to whom he owed service was a textile plantation called Garments of the Greater South, of Pinewoods, Alabama, a Tuscaloosa suburb. A man had run. It was my job to find him.
Victor, how is your progress?
I took a quick drag off the baba. Well, the good father and I broke bread. My name is Dirksen. My wife is Gentle, and she is bound to subterranean service in Carolina. More silence on the other end. Mr. Bridge, not interested in the nitty-gritty. Mr. Bridge, waiting for information. He and I had never met face-to-face, but we'd been talking on the phone now going on 6 years, and I had a clear picture in my mind of the man behind the desk in Gaithersburg, upright, behind his computer keyboard, with a round, pale face and pink jowls. A conservative mustache, maybe, thick but well-kept. Eyes flat, like silver dollars. The only snag is, I said, our friend Barton does not deal in runners, not him and not his church, not anyone he's ever met. He was shocked by the very idea.
He's lying.
Yeah, no shit.
He's sniffing you out.
Let him sniff.
You'll get to him.
I'll try. Bridge repeated himself, not insistent, not chastising, just a statement of fact.
You'll get to him.
This was how the man talked. Clear pronouncements of uncomplicated truth. Never in our years of working together had I detected a note of sarcasm or subtlety. His tone was always the same, cold and unbending like iron. The hint of a southern accent coming up off his voice like the whisper of smoke from a gun barrel.
You'll get to him.
My arrangement with Mr. Bridge was simple. Clear as a searchlight, strong as the law. Under the Fugitive Persons Act, those who escape from service are to be captured and returned anywhere they are found in the United States, slave state or free. All law enforcement agencies are obliged to assist in these operations when called upon, as indeed all good citizens are so obliged. But it is the U.S. Marshals Service that is specifically charged with the job. This law was passed in the ancient year of 1793 under its old name, but it's been updated repeatedly, strengthened in 1850, reinforced in 1861, revised and strengthened a half a dozen times since. When, in 1875, Congress at last ended slavery in the nation's capital, the slaveholding powers were appeased by the raising of fees for obstruction. When President Roosevelt in 1935 proposed the creation of a comprehensive regulatory framework for the plantations and the Bureau of Labor Practices to enforce it, he quieted howling Southern senators with a sweeping immunity bill, shielding U.S. Marshals from zealous Northern prosecutors. Tit for tat. Give and take. Negotiation and conciliation. Compromise. That's how the Union survives. People still find ways to evade the burdens of the FPA, though. Local sheriffs sandbag investigations. State legislatures pass thinly veiled personal liberty laws no matter how many times the Supreme Court sends them back stamped unconstitutional. Plenty of good citizens go to jail every year rather than lift a finger to assist a slave-hunting marshal. Since 1970, African-American law enforcement officers are allowed to claim non-participation under the Moore Amendment. The U.S. Marshal Service, therefore, has needed to find other means of pursuing its mission. That was me. I was other means. A man with no name, a quasi-employee of a clandestine branch moving from city to city, job to job, under the supervision of a voice on a Maryland telephone. Bridge assigned me my cases, but my tactics were up to me. I pursued my cases efficiently and effectively, and as long as I did that, my own past remained buried. I remained in the North and free. Give and take. Negotiation and conciliation. Compromise. When we were done on the phone, I was feeling low and mean, which is how I always felt after talking to Mr. Bridge. Certain emotions were bubbling up in my stomach, close to my throat. Certain kinds of memories were rattling their chains, as always. I flicked away the butt of the shitty Pakistani cigarette and stared out from the darkness of the balcony into the greater darkness of the parking lot, feeling as if I barely existed at all. I did, though. I was real, and the case was real. Somewhere in this city there was a lonesome runner, terrified and tired and overwhelmed by the sights and the lights of the free world. And I was going to find him. Have him dragged home. Home. The full file would come tomorrow, like Bridge said. Tomorrow, my search would begin in earnest.
Chapter 5. It is remarkable when you consider it. All the complicated works we construct to avoid anything that might disturb us or cause us pain. The bulwarks and baffles we build up, the moats and the mazes. When I got down to the lobby the next morning, Thursday morning, my head was clear and I felt focused and calm. I had slept well. It was just before 7:30 a.m., and I was the only one in the complimentary breakfast area off the main lobby of the Crossroads Hotel. That's how I like it. I like to get down to these free breakfasts after they set everything out before the crowds of folks come in, smiling and chattering and buttering their toast. I'm not a man for small talk in the mornings. I found a seat by the window and set down my newspaper on the table to claim it. I always try to stay at hotels that have these kinds of free breakfasts. Warming trays brimming with bacon and herb diced potatoes, bottomless cups of coffee, sweet muffins and paper wrappers. It is my practice to savor whatever is there to be savored, whatever is available, whatever they just put out for you to take. I scanned the front page of the Indianapolis Star, which was all about Donatella Batlish, she of the firestorm, the one who had struck the match. She was the president's nominee to chair the Securities and Exchange Commission, and someone had dug up her master's thesis, which highlighted the range of instruments available under existing law to punish investment companies that trade in plantation profit. Then Batlish gave an interview, Time or U.S. News, one of those, refusing to disavow her views, saying only that she discharged the duties of the office without prejudice. And then the president, an avowed centrist on the old question, as you had to be to get to be president, had surprised everybody by declining to withdraw her nomination. "Is this a watershed moment?" said the page one editorial I was staring at now, chewing on my bagel. "Is this a moment when things begin to change?" "No," I said to the paper, "it's not." I took another bite. I turned the page. A girl came in. A white girl in blue jeans and a blue jean jacket and massively scuffed black Doc Marten-type shoes. She had an oversized leather pocketbook, this young lady. And as I watched, she began casually dropping items into the big bag's maw. This little white lady needed to refine her thievery skills, that was for sure. With each act of petty pilferage, she looked first right, then left, like a cartoon mouse about to grab a hunk of cheese, before dropping whatever it was, a banana, a single-serving box of muesli, into the big purse. A hotel man came in, khaki pants and polo shirt, treading silently enough on the thick carpeting to escape the girl's attention, although I, a great noticer of small sounds, heard him fine. He waited, watching, arms folded across his chest as the girl helped herself to one of the paper cups stacked beside the coffee machine and began to fill it with the 2% milk meant for cereal.
Miss, he said suddenly, loudly, may I help you?
What?
The woman turned quickly, jerked the paper cup from the milk dispenser, sloshed some over the sides.
No, you're fine, I'm good, thanks.
The hotel man walked over to her, brisk and self-important in his slacks and magenta shirt with Crossroads Hotel sewn on the breast pocket. I turned my eyes back to my newspaper, studied the headlines. The Batlish hearings. The Pacers win a close one. Wilmington joins Syracuse and Detroit in bankruptcy. And what cities will be next?
The food set out for breakfast is intended for use during the breakfast hour only.
Oh, wait.
The girl tried on a smile, looked around. She couldn't even figure out a lie for it.
I mean, yes. Oh, of course.
The man studied her.
I'm sorry, would you remind me what room you are staying in?
He had that voice that hotel managers must learn in hotel manager school, smooth and fussy and disapproving. The girl's smile was flickering, fading.
Okay, she said.
She fiddled with a barrette she had in her hair, a bright yellow butterfly.
I'm not remembering right this second.
Well, perhaps if you showed me your key card.
The manager's clipped-on name tag said Mr. Paulson, but I already knew his name. I recognized him. A gleaming bald scalp and small features too small for his big head that made him look blandly sinister. He was the guy who checked me in yesterday, given me my key card, and had me sign the register for guests of color.
Just go ahead and jot down your full name and date of birth and social security number if you don't mind.
Giving me the old standby,
it's the corporate policy, but if it were up to me,
I didn't take offense. I was very used to it. I stayed at a lot of hotels.
Okay, so I don't have a key card,
the white girl was saying, shifting from foot to foot on her big shoes.
See, so we are staying here, or I mean, we're going to be.
Before the first of the wheeze, she stumbled. Just a little bit.
I'm sorry, said Mr. Paulson. You're going to be staying here?
I was paying close attention, half hidden behind the paper, eating my bagel. It was a novelty, I suppose, hearing that kind of petty authoritarian bullying, that ugly, half-threatening tone used against a white person. She was a small thing, this young lady, girlish in her form and her face, with warm brown circles for eyes and thin pink lips, and a lot of messy brown hair pinned up with the plastic yellow butterfly. And here's this manager hectoring and the woman just nodding like a school kid taking a scolding, tears coming into her eyes and her cheeks flushing and her eyes slowly widening.
Yeah, see, okay, I'm up from Evansville for the job fair. Medical job fair, you know? I was a medical assistant, a home health aide, actually. I'm looking for a new, whatever. The point is, my sister said her place was cool to crash, but then I guess her boyfriend is around or, I don't know, something or other.
She grinned, sheepish, at Paulson, who moved not a muscle on his face, gave her nothing.
Sorry, too much information, right? But I'm gonna need the room tonight, swear to God.
She shrugged, smiled one more time.
Room comes with breakfast, right?
Breakfast is complimentary, yes, and you will be entitled to one. Once you are a guest.
Other guests had filled the dining area. A pair of pale businessmen, overweight and ruddily jowled, napkins tucked into dress shirts. A trio of college kids, all girls, in long prairie skirts looking like evangelicals. Everyone working hard at not noticing the showdown at the buffet line. And then there was a little boy, tugging on my sleeve. I looked down at him and he grinned up at me.
Hey, what's that say?
The boy was black, face full of happy mischief, round cheeks, skin a handsome high yellow, eyes deep, beautiful pools. His shirt had a picture of Captain America on it. He had scooted in next to my elbow and was trying to read the front page upside down. The situation came into sharp focus all at once. The white woman's we. Mr. Paulson giving her the business. Young white mother with her black son trying to live in the world. This world.
You couldn't, like, front me a breakfast, she was saying? Like, advance it to me?
No, said Mr. Paulson. Our policy does not allow for that.
The word policy, like a gate coming down, and the next thing would be,
I'm afraid I will have to call security if...
Her son, meanwhile, who was maybe 6 or 7, had eased up beside me with no reservations and was peering at my paper up on his tiptoes.
What word's that?
Controversy, I told him. Pointed to the capital C.
He nodded, oh.
Bothering me without qualm. The brave, sweet boy. I wondered that nobody had told him not to talk to strangers. Maybe black strangers were okay. This kid moved his mouth, squinting at the word controversy.
Ma'am, if you please.
Hey, you know what? It's fine. Slowly and with exaggerated dignity, the white girl removed her contraband from her pocketbook. 3 muffins, one by one. The cereal box, the banana, and 2 oranges. Then 2 plastic spoons and a yogurt. These items she placed in a line along the buffet table like sacrificial offerings, while her nemesis in his magenta shirt stood with arms crossed. And as she came over to my table to retrieve her son, the girl caught my eye and gave me this fleeting, rueful look. The meaning perfectly clear. This guy, huh? What a dickhead. It is a marker of the kind of relationship I had with white people in general and with white women in particular. Having to do not only with the caution that adheres to my profession, but also with my upbringing, the way I was raised, that I did not return her look. I made myself busy, reaching across the table for a fresh napkin, and while I was busy, she scooped up her boy and bore him away, the front section of my star dangling from his forefingers across her back like a cape. I sat there feeling that for a beat or two, then I folded up what was left of my paper. Fussy little Mr. Paulson strode self-importantly from the breakfast nook, not bothering to apologize for the scene. Not to the likes of me. The white girl's car was not hard to find in the parking lot. A beat-up South African shitbox with a dented driver's side door and a bright pink paint job that was peeling and rust-splotched. The automotive analog of the denim jacket and scuffed Doc Martens. She was in the driver's seat, filling out the top application on a whole stack of them. The stack balanced atop a hardcover book that was in turn balanced on her lap. She wore a look of troubled concentration, her eyes screwed up, a strand of her hair tucked into the corner of her mouth. Her boy was in the shotgun seat, one leg lodged against the glove compartment, playing some sort of handheld electronic game. I thought about rapping on the window, but then I didn't. I left the food I had gathered up, still on its tray, on the ground just outside the driver's side, and went off to work. Chapter 6. I parked my car on the street beside a graveyard about a quarter mile west of the address and walked the long couple of blocks as the day got itself going, the sun spreading out slowly onto the blacktop. It wasn't raining, but it felt like it wanted to, clouds glowering, crowded, low down in the sky. As I walked toward Mapleton Fall Creek, I crossed Central Avenue, and looking south, I could see what appeared to be the smoke from a dozen small fires rising up and mingling from campsites and cookouts, clustered tents. That had to be Freedman Town, another 5 miles downtown and a universe away. Maybe it was as simple as that. Maybe the man I sought was lying desperate under a torn blanket somewhere in Freedman Town, crammed in among second cousins in an unheeded efficiency. The classic move, the fool's move, the move of a desperate runner. It wouldn't be that easy, though. If Bridges' office thought it was as easy as creeping into Freedman Town and knocking on a couple of doors, that's what I'd be doing. Or actually, my services would not have been thought necessary. The white vans would roll up on Freedman Town with no help from me. Mapleton Fall Creek, by contrast, looked to be a tidy little neighborhood of one-story aluminum-sided bungalows, their trim green front yards like welcome mats. The homes were old, but well-tended. Their small wooden porches cluttered with outdoor furniture, rocking chairs, and love seats. Every house was painted some bright color, and it looked like the Block Association had gotten together to make sure nobody came dressed to the party the same. A powder blue house, a chipper yellow house, one of green and one of pink. One house had a black and white dog yipping behind a short chain-link fence. The next place had a string of Christmas lights dangling from the gutters, put up either early or way too late. Up on one of these porches was a very old black woman, her hair in curlers for the day to come, rocking slowly on her rocking chair. She waved, and I waved back. A nice little neighborhood was the vibe I was getting, a black neighborhood, working people, poor but proud. Kind of place a white person might drive through with the doors locked, thinking it's dangerous for no reason except the color of its occupants.
I came out onto 38th and turned right, past a run of businesses, everything closed up tight this early morning. A clothing shop called The Big and the Tall, a barber shop called Men and Ladies, a steak and lemonade place called just Steak and Lemonade, one sad liquor store with the paint peeling from around the door frame, with a solitary drunk smoking in an oversized warm-up jacket, playing it cool, dying for the place to open. This is where he had come, cherry-cheeked Father Barton on Sunday afternoon. He was down in this unlikely neighborhood for some reason, and he had stopped at that bank right over there, the one next to the gas station that's next to Captain D's fish fry, to take out a couple $100, which was gone from his wallet by supper time last night. The ATM stood under a little green awning just to the right of the front door of the bank proper. As I ambled toward it, I felt my body take on the young father's spirit, the righteous white man walking upright and unafraid in a black neighborhood, a man of the people wearing his serious, sacred expression. I stood at the cash machine a second. Then I did a slow 360, even going so far as to mime the action of taking out a wallet, tucking bills inside it, putting it away again. Halfway through my turn, I was looking down the cross street, Central Avenue, toward the south. Down there, a block down, a streetlight was blinking, reflecting itself back murkily in a pothole full of rainwater. On one side of the road was a weedy vacant lot, and across the street was a small, white-painted building with a wooden cross hanging above the door. The sign beneath the cross said, St. Anselm's Catholic Promise, Community Welcome. All right now, I said, hastening my step, bobbing my head. All right, all right. Approaching the building, I heard the rush and roar of a small engine, and then I saw him. A groundskeeper, hunched over and focused, working a leaf blower in an even line along the curb, throwing clouds of dirt and detritus off the sidewalk into the road. "Hey, hey, man," I said, waving my hands as I came up the sidewalk. "Hold up a sec." The groundskeeper looked up, weary and wary, but he killed the engine. "Oh, yeah, hey, man, hey." I rolled into the character as I came up on him, taking on a little decrepitude, a little stagger in my walk, a little grit in my eyes. Drifter, knucklehead, working on that good early morning drunk. "How you feeling, brother?" "What can I help you with?" The gardener was a tired, middle-aged black man, a dozen lifetimes of this kind of yard work bullshit already behind him. Not old, but getting there fast. Tired this morning. Bones and fingers tired. Wanting to get this job done, get back in his truck before the rain came, if it was coming. "Yeah, yeah," I said, talking quickly, licking my lips, addled and rapid. "Yeah, I tell you, man, I've been wandering, you feel me? Been wandering today." He raised his eyebrows just the tiniest bit. He wore forest green coveralls with the name Reuben stitched into a white oval above the breast pocket, and Circle City Lawnscaping in big stenciled block letters on the back. I hustled out my words. "Yeah, so I saw this was a church, okay? And I just felt like I had to come on down here, because listen, man, it just happens. I've been hearing the angels, man, and they've been saying I need to get right with God. Angels been saying what I need to do is go on and get right today."
"Well, you won't be doing it here, man." Reuben turned his cracked lips up for a brief smile. "This is not a church. It's a community center."
"What?
Oh. Church own it. But it ain't a church. And it's closed, man."
"Well, shit."
Reuben liked that. He ground out a laugh, gravelly and low. "Sorry, boss. The, what you call it? You know, the diocese. They closed this place up a while back, 6 months ago or something. They got us coming by once a week to keep it from getting overgrown and all, that's it."
"Oh, wow, 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 wow. Guess my angels got their wires crossed."
"I guess they did." We both laughed a little then, me and my man, Reuben. And I stood and swayed in my drunkenness and shook my head and took a good hard look at that building. Not so grand a structure as St. Catherine's up there on Meridian Street. Not by a long shot. Old, wood-sided, one-storied, a flat black roof. The front of the building had but one door, up a short walkway lined with box hedges and ivy. One of the windows was broken, a shatter scar down the middle of it like an unhealed wound. At the door handle, though, was a bright glint of gold. I held my eyes to that door for a second, squinting hopefully as if to open it by force of will and get the salvation I was seeking. All right, well, Reuben raised his leaf blower. I better get back to it.
Hold up a sec, I said in a burst of inspiration. Y'all hiring?
His brows arched with fresh skepticism.
I don't know. You gotta ask Rick about that.
Rick?
Yeah, Rick. Oh, I guess Rick or Tiny.
Tiny?
That's right.
You got a number?
It's on the truck, man.
Reuben was done with me. He turned away and fired up his leaf blower and called, "Good luck!" over its roar as I tippled over to that truck. A Pakistani pickup on high wheels, towing an enclosed flatbed trailer cluttered with mowers and rakes and shit. Both the truck and the trailer had Circle City Lawnscaping painted on the side, and under the name was the number. The whole community center was about as big as a Monopoly house, and it looked older than sin. Older than Adam and Eve the sinners. Except for the lock on the door. That lock was brass, and it looked shiny and new. I smiled to myself as I got the number off the side of the truck, feeling pretty pleased at having noticed that detail. Happy about having gotten, guided by the ATM receipt, to the bank, to the Catholic Community Center, to Reuben, to the door. Happy with all I'd done even before Bridge and his people managed to get me the full file. I was feeling the pleasure of discovery, the pleasure of the job. That's the problem with doing the devil's work. It can be pretty satisfying now and again. Pretty goddamn satisfying. I had with me in Indianapolis all my usual equipment. Some of it was in my room at the Capital City Crossroads. Some of it was stashed in the trunk of the car. A variety of costume pieces, some wigs, some fake jewelry, and various basic elements of facial camouflage. A tube of spirit gum, a few shades of foundation, and eyebrow pencil. I had 6 different pairs of clear glass spectacles and 6 different sets of colored contact lenses. Other tools, too. A set of picks and rakes for cracking locks, plus a backup set. Lanyards with name tags, fake badges and fake badge holders, clothes and shoes. My phone and its charger and its various accessories, the computer, paperwork for Jim Dirksen, and 3 more complete sets on 3 other names. All of it comprehensively backstopped, every phone number connected to a real phone, a real person who knew what to say if somebody called. Cash, too, of course. Rolls of bills and rubber bands available for my use for incidental expenses, all of which were to be reported at the completion of each assignment. I had a gun, but it stayed in the hotel. Almost all the time, that's where I kept it. I am an undercover operative in a dangerous line of work. But understand that I am also an African-American male living in the United States of America. There are going to be checkpoints. I am going to get stopped. Every once in a while, I'm going to have to dump out my bag under the watchful eye of some kind of lawman. Sheriff's deputy, patrol officer, state trooper, what have you. Might just be some shopping center wage slave shithead rolling up on his Segway, flashing his costume shop tin, wanting to prove his cock size to the girl at the sunglasses kiosk. When that sort of BS happened, I had no choice but to submit. I had no badge, no ID. I was true undercover right down the line. If you saw the way I traveled, if you went through my suitcase or the trunk of my car, you'd think I was a thief, some kind of con man. Which I was, of course. Really, that's exactly what I was. I was a thief. I was some kind of con man. When I got back outside, I found a police car parked right alongside my Altima. Just outside the cemetery gate. I stopped and I stared at it for a second. An IMPD black and white with stenciled letters on the side and the sirens on the roof and the long radio antenna sticking up stiff and proud from the rear. I glanced up and down the street to see if the owner was around, but it was just as quiet as it had been before. Even the sky, still gray and cool, the clouds right where I had left them. Everything same as it was, except for the marked car. I bounced on my heels a couple times, as if my body were getting ready to take off running. But I didn't do that. I didn't do anything. I just stood there, looking at the rear bumper of that police vehicle, looking at the gravestones, at the houses down the street, an uneasy feeling gathering and drifting in me like mist. I was thinking that there had been 2 cops in the Fountain Diner last night, a black one and a white one, a couple tables over from the priest and me. Looking at something on one of their phones, laughing and carrying on. Slowly I approached the parked police vehicle, listening to the distant, indistinct sounds of the city. Someone honking somewhere, a doorway gate rattling up, maybe Steak and Lemonade or the Big and the Tall opening for the day. I committed the number to memory. Car number 101097. Big city, I was thinking. Big city full of cops. That's all. Chapter 7.
What is this? What is this now?
I was standing on the hotel room's rickety wooden chair so the top of my head grazed the ceiling. I had a halfway decent printer, government issue and portable, but it worked just fine. And when a file came in, it was my practice to print it and lay the sheets out on the hotel bedspread in a grid and study them from above, as though I were doing helicopter surveillance on a city block. The full file was a goddamn mess, and I was not pleased. I hate mess. I hate unevenness and uncertainty, and that's what the full file was. It was uneven and uncertain. It was mid-afternoon already. The file had appeared on the second server by noon, as promised, and I'd been staring at its ugly sheets since then, scowling at them, drinking water from the cheap hotel room tumbler, puzzling over the 9 pages of closely typed text and illustrations and thinking the same thing. What a goddamn mess. The first 3 pages of the file concerned Father Barton and his cell of the Underground Airlines. And this section was short on details and long on conjecture, pure search engine bullshit. Some intern in Bridge's office had strung it together from old arrest warrants and radical abolition chat rooms. Barton's birth date, town of origin, known and suspected associates. His close ties to the International Canaan Organization, ICO, and Le Bénévole Blackburn. His loose ties to the Black Panthers and two other domestic terror organizations. His name in connection with a nasty incident 22 months ago. A body found in a crate in a Cincinnati FedEx routing center, never delivered, substantially decayed. This corpse was eventually ID'd with a PIN and a service name. A runner from Boone County, Carolina, who'd gotten himself crated and sent to St. Catherine's Cathedral, Indiana. The FedEx employee who'd facilitated this Hail Mary maneuver, an ABO sympathizer working freelance, was in federal prison but could not be persuaded to admit he'd been acting on Barton's behest. At least, that is, not according to this useless, messy bullshit file. All these first few pages did was tell me what I already knew. That despite his claims of innocence, the parish priest was a prolific smuggler of runaways, directly or indirectly responsible for dozens of illegal manumissions over the last several years. Bridge, or Bridge's intern, had a high degree of certainty, whatever the fuck that meant, that it was Barton and his group who'd pulled Jackdaw off the plantation and or gotten him across the fence. They were equally certain it was Barton's people shielding the boy till he could be moved across the 49th parallel to permanent freedom. I scowled. I shifted my weight. My eyes flickered past the hole in my grid, a gap like a vacant lot in a row of homes. That was page 7. And I hadn't printed it. I wasn't ready to look at it, not yet. The section about Garments of the Greater South Incorporated wasn't much more useful. Nothing that any mope couldn't have pulled from public records. Total acreage, acreage devoted to production, total annual yield, yield of upland, yield of American Pima. Gross annual revenue, gross annual profit, projected future revenue. Every time I read about one of these places, they'd gotten bigger, more modern, larger in scope, and more sophisticated in their operations. This one, this GGSI, boasted of having customers in 72 countries around the world for its durable high-fineness fibers and its premium-rated seeds and seed oils. GGSI housed the Institute for Agricultural Innovation, with support from the state of Alabama and the American Cotton Council, performing cutting-edge research on new technologies in the production of pest- and drought-resistant cotton strains. GGSI had 4,232 persons bound to labor on its sprawling campus, in its fields, in its factories, in its offices. 4,231, I thought. As of Sunday night, 4,231. There was an aerial photograph of the facility in there, too. A smudged satellite image with every blurry rectangle numbered and labeled. 32 separate structures. I let my finger move from rectangle to rectangle. I traced the lines between the buildings along the service roads and gravel paths connecting them. Fighting off a burst of dread imagination, me down in there, running in slave grays from building to building, from shipping and receiving to facilities maintenance, bare feet slapping the paths. The population center was five buildings arranged in a semicircle around a courtyard labeled Recreation. Five grim rectangles of identical dimensions.